I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to the Writer's Routine podcast. My name is Dan Simpson. Thank you so much for downloading. This is the show where we get advice and inspiration for that book that's knocking around your head right now. We get it by chatting to authors who have been there, who have seen it, who have done it, and who have got the promo t-shirts with the big picture of their book on. Today, we'll hear from an ex-copper whose career in the force made him a bestseller. It's the part of the show where I get needy and wanty and kind of do the podcast equivalent of grovelling on my knees. Because if you've enjoyed the writer's routine so far at all, and you've got any tips or advice from the authors we've interviewed so far, I would love it if you could get onto the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. A good review, that is. If you were going to leave a bad one, you can just click stop on your listening device right now. That's okay with me. Also, drop some stars as well. 5 would be amazing. That is 5. Because the way the kind of podcast game works is with surge of energy, surge of momentum. So the more reviews we get, the higher we'll get in the charts, and the more people will know, can listen to the show, and can get more help from loads of successful authors as well. So if you've enjoyed the show, that's what you can do. Get out your phone right now and leave us a review on the iTunes podcast store. Paul Finch is the author of the best-selling Heck novels. They're all about D.S. Mark Heckenberg, who is a policeman. And Paul knows exactly how to write about that, right? He used to work for the Greater Manchester Police. And as you'll hear, he mined his experiences fully to get the stories on paper. It's not just crime he's worked on, though. He's had loads of award nominations for his horror books. He's also done stuff with Doctor Who, for films, for animation, even for The Bill, too. Now, I chatted to Paul a few weeks ago, and one thing that I didn't notice at the time, but became abundantly and irritatingly clear during the edit, was there was a really annoying aircon fan whirring away the whole time. I'm really sorry about that. I hope it's not too distracting. I just don't have the talent to cut it out. Also, I realised I really do love talking to authors about their characters. Because they speak not just like it's their best mate or like a member of their family, but it's kind of like their identical twin, conjoined twin type of thing, who like lives in their head the whole time and they share thoughts. There's something so real about it, and Paul speaks about Heck exactly that way. You'll hear it in just a sec. Plus, Paul's writing routine is different from, I reckon, about 90% of every other author around. And if you're struggling to put a pen to paper, the advice that Paul gives might really help you out. Also, we'll get a weird and wonderful writing routine from history with our Distinguished Diaries feature in a bit. Today, it is 11 Commandments for Success from Henry Miller, and he knew what he was on about. That's on the way in a sec. First then, let's get into my chat with Paul Finch, the crime and horror author, about his writer's routine.
When I actually start to write the book, what's in front of me? Well, I'll tell you what's in front of me. I think this will be different to a lot of people. 2 Springer Spaniels on a lead in the woods, because I always dictate my first draft when I'm walking. That's part of the it's part of a fitness drive to just keep walking all the time. I could have a very sedentary life. I think that's the correct term, isn't it? I could be stuck in front of a computer 24/7. I don't want to do that. I've done that in other jobs. I And I just find now that going almost whatever the weather, I get out there and I walk and I dictate my first, the whole book, not always in one go, but in chapters. I mean, and I, when I say all weathers, I mean, I wrote a, the last Doctor Who book I wrote was in the winter of 2010 when it was like minus 15 and heavy snow, and I still went out and did it because I just preferred that to being stuck in my office all day.
So how did that develop, this did you the very first book you ever sat down to write, did you sit down, did you do it sedentary, or was it always the plan to go and record
yourself?
I think
I probably started like everybody else, you know, sitting in front of a computer and initially sort of hypnotized by a blank screen and then starting to type it out. But it just, when we got, I mean, we've always been a dog family. And, you know, we have dogs that need exercise. So the dogs tend to, I began to combine it. I had a dictaphone. I found it was quite easy. I was writing the bill before I was writing books, which is essentially dialogue. And I find the dialogue, writing dialogue when I'm out and about, quite easy. I don't know, it just comes natural to me. For example, with my novels, I tend to write the dialogue first when I'm dictating. It then has to be typed up later on. It isn't a finished draft by any means, and it isn't something that an app could just reproduce, could type for you, because it would be gibberish. Your first draft, when you do it this way, tends to be almost like streams of conscious thought broken up into, you know, incorrect sentences with no real structure, but everything's in roughly the right order. So when it comes to me typing it out, it's just 90 miles an hour, because all I'm doing is just correcting everything as I go along, and it's a great way of doing it. That's the first draft, though. I mean, I know some writers don't like to plan. I do a detailed plan, but that changes.
So this is before you've set out on your walks with your dictaphone, you've sat down.
Yeah, that's notepad and pen. I have a detailed plan, but I'm flexible. I'm not hidebound by the plan. If a better idea comes up halfway along, that's the way I go. But by the same token, if a better idea comes up and it involves changing everything I've done before, I'll do that, if it's a better idea. I kind of know where I know where I'm starting and I know where I need to finish. So I'm still essentially following the plan. But and when you're dictating, it's quite liberating, because you can make footnotes and anything you want. I mean, you can have all kinds of ideas. So, for example, you know, you may think halfway through, you may think, actually, that's a better name for that character than I've been using. So I just say it, you know, change the character's name, go back and change it to Daddy Nan. And for me, it works. I mean, there are drawbacks, for example, in when I was using, I mean, now it's a digital device I use. Previously, it would be a battery-powered tape recorder. Well, there was nothing worse than the tape having ended an hour earlier and you didn't realise it, because it didn't give you any kind of signal, or the battery having run out and not telling you anything. So there are occasions when I've come back thinking I've done a day's work and I've got nothing. The thing I find the easiest is interaction between characters. That may be my scriptwriting background coming up a little bit. If I find, I mean, I get a lot of praise, if I may say so myself, for my action sequences, because my Heck novels in particular have big, protracted action sequences in them. But I find those, they have to be right. So you've got to, it's all about timing. And I always think of an action sequence, I don't want to veer off into action sequences at this stage, but it is relevant to your question, a kind of an assault on the senses. It's not just a straightforward narrative. So I layer action sequences. So for example, I did in Hunted, after a bank robbery sequence, there was a car chase across South London. That took me 2 weeks to write that sequence. I even walked the route, and I had spoke to some chaps in London traffic, because as an ex-copper, I have a few useful contacts, about the most destructive route we could take. But the funny thing is that it took me 2 weeks to write, and it probably is 2 pages of the book. And yet the funny thing is, I'm in quite good company there. And I was only told this later on, because if you remember the film The French Connection, there's a very famous sequence where they chase a train into this. There's a car chase into New York and it's chasing a train. It's one of the most amazing action scenes ever put on film. And apparently that took them 6 weeks to film, and it's six minutes in the film. So it's kind of the same ratio, if you know what I mean. I'm not putting myself in that category, by the way. But I had to kind of do day after day of planned dictation walks to get that sequence right. Maybe people can. I mean, it was described in one review as the mother of all car chases, so I was quite happy with that. So it kind of worked. But other things, you know, I mean, I find descriptive passages, I wouldn't say challenge, they're just more demanding because you want it to be right. You know, so I have to work slightly harder on others. So I may say I'm taking the dog out for an hour to get this one page description of whatever part of the countryside it is right.
Let's get some sort of form to this. Talk me through an average day of your first draft from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed when you're sat there writing.
Right, well, an average, the first couple of hours will be, I mean, usually the first hour is dealing with correspondence, publicity type stuff. I mean, I know that's probably a bit sort of a bit dry, but yeah, we all have to find ways to talk about ourselves online without talking about ourselves. So if there's some blogging to do, or if people are dropping me a nice line on Facebook or Twitter saying how much they enjoyed the last book, I always try to respond personally, that kind of thing. Usually that's an hour.
What time is this of the day?
This would be from sort of 8 o'clock onwards. I mean, obviously there are breaks because life gets in the way. I mean, my office is at home. As I say, most of the time I'm the only person there, but the dogs are bouncing around the house barking at the postman and that kind of things, and the window cleaner, so there's all those little things. I may have a few bits and pieces of the previous day to finish off, because I try and get a certain amount done every day. I usually hit the road around 11 to half 11. That would be my first dictation walk of the day, because there are usually two. I get back in, if I'm lucky, I might get 1,000 words out of what that, because I usually get back in about two, have a bite of lunch, then the afternoon is typing all that up.
Oh, so it all happens on the same day?
Yeah, but then it's only as much, but then I go do another dictation walk from half past five onwards, usually till about half past seven. Half past seven, you know, by this time my wife Kathy is home and we have dinner. If I'm really pushed, I go back to work sort of half eight, usually till about midnight. But I don't really like working in the evening because you're tired. So what I tend to do in the evening, if I'm able to, is do other related stuff. Again, blogging, this kind of thing. Because I do a lot of blogging. And it's not just about me, other writers, book reviews, this kind of thing. So my blog is a kind of epicentre of what I refer to as dark fiction. So it's sort of crime, thrillers, horror, science fiction, that kind of thing. So I talk about widely about all these things. And I try and do at least two blogs a month, and they're big ones, you know, they're kind of 3,000-4,000 word blogs. So that's my day. I mean, as I say, I'm not hidebound. If I'm really up against a deadline, everything can just be thrown away and I just have to go for it, you know, until it's done.
How much research do you have to do to make sure what you're talking about is right, not just geographically? I know you were a police officer yourself, but also so you know.
Well,
the details of what you are putting down is correct.
I know exactly what you mean. It's a good question. In the first three, I mean, there are six books so far. I'm writing the seventh at the moment. In the first instances, I tried to stick with areas I knew reasonably well. I'm a native of the Northwest, Lancashire, Manchester. So that's come up on several occasions. But also, I've lived in South East and North London. So I know London well.
You invented the department that he works in. How truthful are you with the rest of the details in the book? Are you perfectly fine to invent another way, a place in Humberside?
Well, I mean, fiction is where I live. So, for example, my national crime group doesn't actually exist. I think the problem is that, you know, what a lot of readers don't get is that when you're writing about real places, you have to be a little bit careful. So in Ashes to Ashes, which is loosely based on the town of my birth, Wigan, but it's the town that I grew up in as a teenager, so it's horrible. It's a real mess. It's a real industrial mess, which it isn't anymore. So the point was, I thought, well, I can't call it Wigan, so I invented a town. I just called it Bradburn, but it's in exactly the same place on a map, and people kind of accept that. I mean, they were less accepting initially of fiction and real life merging together.
We'll get more from Paul Finch in just a sec, where we'll talk about plotting, about whether being a regimented, disciplined policeman has influenced his writing style at all, and also we'll find out how closely he likes to stick to that famous three-act structure.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's time to get a weird and wonderful writing routine from history in our halftime show of a feature, Distinguished Diaries. Now, Henry Miller was like an uber creative. He was an author and a writer. He was known for his works Tropic of Capricorn, The Time of the Assassins, and for the way he broke the literary style of the day and how he would discuss sex, surrealist themes, society, swearing, and kind of in a way that no one was really doing back then. And in 1932, he released a book called Henry Miller on Writing, which did exactly what it says on the tin. In it are a list of 11 commandments that he tried to follow every single day to help with successful writing, and they're brilliant. And they still work today, like almost 90 years later. Number one, he says to work on one thing at a time until it's finished. And that is really hard today, what with the internet, and you're allowed about 1,000 tabs to keep distracting you while you're working. Number two, he says start no more books. That's really key. Keep one idea in your mind at a time. Number three, don't be nervous. He says work calmly, joyously, recklessly on whatever is in hand. Dive fully into it. Number four, he says work according to this program and not according to mood. And stop at the appointed time. Be dedicated and efficient with your creativity, although in a second you'll find that occasionally he just throws that out the window. Number five, he says that when you can't create, you can still work. You can kind of do research for the rest of your book. Number six, cement a little bit every day rather than add new fertilizers. Not really sure what that one means. Number seven, he says keep human, see people, go places, do things, drink if you feel like it. Number eight, another one I'm not too sure about, don't be a draft horse. Work with pleasure only. And number nine, this is what I was talking about. He says, discard the program when you feel like it, but go back to it the next day. Concentrate, narrow down, exclude things. Number 10, I'm not sure about you, I could definitely learn from this one. Forget the books that you want to write. Think of only the book you are writing, because novels have to be like over 70,000 words long. And I definitely get to about 10,000 of one book. I get bored, want to start something different. And your last one, number 11, he says, write first and always. Painting, music, friends, cinema, all these things come afterwards. There are so many lessons there from Henry Miller that we can still learn today. That for creativity to flourish, you need to work hard at it and be dedicated, but also to understand that some days it's almost impossible to tame the beast. Now, as has been made very clear on this show so far, you know, when we talk about how I can never quite finish an idea and that I'm way too distracted by all the other stuff that's out there on the internet to actually concentrate on one thing at a time, bear that in mind, right? I want to tell you about our new website for the show. Now it's in its infancy, and to be honest, it's never likely to be fully complete because of all the concentration stuff that I just confessed to, but it's there. It's online, it's live, you can hear all our old episodes, you can get in touch with the show, suggest authors to interview, and we've got handy links on there to our iTunes and RSS feed as well. So get online, have a look, let me know what you think. It is writersroutine.com. Right, let's get back to the meat of the show then. The reason we're all here, the second part of my chat with crime and horror author Paul Finch on the Writer's Routine. Say for your Heck books, now you know him, you know the character so well, he could be like one of the family. Is it simply a case of having him, thinking of a few situations that he could get into and just dropping him in the middle of them? Or are you more thinking about the overarching plot of the tale and having a good narrative?
Well, I think with the Heck books in particular, because they are... I mean, I have a whole list of Heck ideas, which are no more than a sentence, which anything that strikes me as interesting, whether it's something I see in real life or something I see on the news or something someone tells me in gossip. I mean, I know I've got so many police stories. And it goes down, possible Heck idea, possible Heck idea. That's the way it starts, really. With Heck, it has to have the potential to be... has to have the potential, first of all, for there to be a lot of intense emotional drama between him and Gemma, his ex-girlfriend, who's now his boss. And it's almost invariably because he strays from the protocol. But it has to be frightening. So the villains and the fiendish plots they're evolving have to be much more frightening than the average plot, or much more disturbing. And there has to be potential for action. So in some ways it leans a little bit more towards James Bond than it does towards the average cop thriller, if you know what I mean.
6 Heck books down, you've got the Lucy Claiburns, you've written a lot of other stuff as well. You're well versed in knowing how a story works.
Well, I think so.
When you're plotting your outline, do you have certain things that you need to hit? Certain beginning, middle, end? Is there a certain amount of chapters that you need?
You're talking about the 3-act structure.
And just generally your outline, how, because as you say, you need to release a book every 9 months, it needs to be quite strict. Is there almost a standard template?
Well, people would say there is. It may well be that I have a template that I'm not completely aware of. And the more realistic it is, the more impact the nasty and the action-packed moments have. I may restrict myself to kind of 3 big action sequences in a book, and they're kind of spaced out near the beginning, the middle, and the end. And there's lots of other stuff in between that's relevant. There's lots of unfolding plot. There's lots of character development. There's lots of interaction, which is relevant. And you know, I always believe you've got to, you can't bring in things near the end that no one saw coming. Every solution has to be flagged. It's because it's too easy to bring something in that wasn't in the book. But one other very quick point. I mean, of course, with thrillers, red herrings are always a great device because it adds extra threads of tension. And, of course, they can be resolved during the course of the book.
Apart from the red herring, are there any other kind of hard and fast rules that you live by when you write your thrillers?
I mean, I think with the Heck books, because his personal background is quite relevant to his character... In the first 6 books, I'm hoping there'll be more. There'll be many more. In the first 6 books, we were slowly unfolding book by book terrible events from his early life, which made him the person he is. Now, it's a challenge for me now because in book 6, it's all that is resolved. That's the catharsis. Book 6 is his personal life catharsis. So from here on, it's kind of a blank sheet in that regard. So it's a kind of pastures new thing now. We have to see where we go. So previously, there was always a relevance to it. And I wasn't, you know, don't get me wrong, I wasn't loading him with personal baggage, because that's melodramatic. But there were hints of something terrible happening, and they become more and more important. So there was a kind of developing story arc.
Did you always know that
you wanted certain things of his life resolved within those six books, or did it become apparent?
Well, book I never. Three? I mean, I'll be honest with you. I didn't know how many books there were going to be in the series. I mean, I never thought. I mean, you know, you dream, of course. You think, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to have 30 books? You're never sure that will happen. And I think it's fairly safe that Heck will go on and on because he sells very well overseas as well. If my German publisher told me, you know, they'd publish as many as I could write.
Why do you think that is? If you can be critical to yourself and perhaps a bit blowing smoke up places to yourself, why do you think it is appreciated in other countries as much or more than it is here?
I honestly do not know. I mean, some countries have bought, other countries haven't. I can't explain why that is. I think it's done phenomenally well in Germany. I honestly do not know. It could simply be that he has a German surname, but I don't think. I mean, that's accidental. I never thought about that at the time. I named him Heckenberg after an Australian rugby player. I just thought it was a terrific name. But when he was coming on with ball in hand, and it was, come on, Heck, and I thought, that's a fantastic name. Never occurred to me that, of course, in German it means war tower. So okay. It's quite a dramatic name, but I don't think that's the sole reason. I think it's just that my publishers in Germany market it terrifically well. I mean, I've seen, it's fascinating, people have sent me photographs of billboards with my face on them in Berlin. I've never even been to Berlin.
Or you've unknowingly got a German translator who's writing his own work.
Funnily enough, my German translators are by far the most conscientious. I say that, I'm not critical of other translators, it's just that they're the only ones who send me lots and lots and lots of questions.
Do you remember the first moment that the first Lucy Claiborne novel came into your mind, and then why was it not a Heck book?
Ah, right, good. That's a very good question. It was initially kind of imposed on me. I had never entered my head to write a Lucy Claiborne book until it was suggested that, because female heroes were becoming a big thing about three years ago, had I got any thoughts to do a parallel series with a policewoman? Well, I hadn't, and I didn't mind. It gave me the opportunity maybe to do a more down-to-earth police procedural. There was certainly no point in it just being a female Heck, because that would have been, you know, the same story, basically. So, fortunately, this is the second part of the answer. I already had a character called Lucy Claiborne, who I wrote for a television drama in 1993 called Dirty Work. Now, it was optioned. This was after it was optioned by my former series producer on The Bill, who really liked it. It was about a female detective in Manchester, a young policewoman who was investigating police corruption. Because in the early 90s, the big story was police corruption. All the chickens were coming home to roost from earlier eras, basically. Technology caught up with people, and it was turned out, it found out that notes had not been taken at the time, and all this kind of thing. So certain elite squads across the police forces of the UK were getting their backsides kicked. And she was involved in one such because it had led to a series of underworld murders. Now, I had that. It was optioned. A famous television actress at the time was very keen to do it. But for various reasons, it never got made. And it got shelved. So the character was there in my mind. I liked the idea of she was a kind of bolshy, blue-collar Manchester girl who really spoke her mind and got stuck in. And I started thinking about the police women I knew who had the young, and they were all youngsters, only in their early 20s, who had to go undercover as prostitutes. It was a horrifically dangerous job. Probably the most dangerous job any policewoman could do. And I thought, we could get something out of that. Without it being lurid, this gave me the idea for the first Lucy Claiborne book, and which was about a prostitute murdering her clients. So, of course, that would just not have worked in any way with a Heck story.
Do you think you come at it slightly differently as an author because of your background in the police? Maybe you're more methodical with the way you write. Maybe you're more factual and less head-in-the-sky artistic.
No, I just think I'm in my comfort zone because of it. I mean, I left the police a long time ago. Police protocols have changed dramatically since then. I'm probably as much a knucklehead about the fine details of modern police procedures as anybody else. I mean, I've got lots of friends in the job who I still talk to. I don't worry too much about the fine detail of protocol, because I don't write police textbooks. I write fictional crime thrillers. So I think as long as you get your law right and your forensics right and your power structure right, don't get me wrong, you have to research that. You can't just guess. But by the same token, you know, I think where I do have an advantage is I know the police world. I know the way they talk to each other. I know the way they behave with each other. I know the kind of the relationships between the ranks that would be acceptable and would be unacceptable. What it allows me is freedom to write without, you know, having to pick up at the phone and asking my friends everything. I was the only writer on the bill who didn't need to go on drive-alongs with the police because I just finished doing the job. So I think it just gives me a lot of... it's a much more relaxed thing for me. I'm not unnerved by the prospect of writing about the police, if you know what I mean.
Right, that is it for today's episode of The Writer's Routine. Huge thank you to you for listening. Also, obviously, massive thanks to Paul Finch for taking the time, coming down to London to chat to me for the show. I hope you had fun at the publishing party later that night, mate. And if you get to writersroutine.com right now, you can find out loads more about Paul. And I've got some nice handy links to websites that sell his books as well, which is pretty good. Now, next week, make sure you're back with the show. We're chatting to another man named Paul. Now, this guy, he's now a novelist, and he used to write screenplays for primetime BBC sitcoms. Remember to subscribe on iTunes as well. If you could leave us a review while you're there, that would be amazing. And thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Bye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.